6 minutes past the hour of 12 noon Central Time. Dave Krieger with you on the Power Hour. It's President's Day. Don't forget to use Take 5 and Take 10 as your codes when you call the Power Hour today to get $5 off or 5% off when you mention $5 off when you use the word Take 5 when you spend 50, $10 off when you spend 100. Use the word Take 10. And you got that. It works on thepowermall.com online, or if you call us on the Power Mall phone number at 877-817-9829. And we also want to mention, for those of you who were writing down the address, it's P.O. Box 519, Marshfield, Missouri, 65706. It's P.O. Box 519. For those of you who want to send a donation by mail, we appreciate that. And speaking of the people that donate a lot of their time and energy in getting stuff done, being this is President's Day, we thought we'd have a little George Washington special treat for you. Jerry Newcomb has been on the show before, and he is an executive producer, writer, and director. He's one of the nation's leading voices on American history with a Christian perspective, and Lord knows, in this day and age, we need that more than everything and anything to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and our Christian way of life here in America. Once again, on Washington's birthday, President's Day, welcome to the show again, Pastor Newcomb.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Not a problem. And you are the executive director of the Providence Forum, which is at providenceforum.org. For those of you who want to know the website, let's talk about where this whole thing fits in perspective. You have a new video out, George Washington film, part of the Foundation film series on America's Christian roots. So can you give us a little overview on what the movie's about? Obviously, George.
Sure. It's first of all, in the whole series of the Foundation on American Liberty series, this is the only one that is just a full-blown biography of any one person. But, of course, George Washington, being the father of our country, had such a great influence on the founding of America and so many of the positive things that we dedicated a whole episode to him. And we were very pleased to get some really great guests like Dr. Peter Loback, with whom I wrote the book called George Washington, Sacred Fire, which became a bestseller about 14 or 15 years ago. And we had Daniel Dreisbach in this, and even the late Dr. Walter Williams. In fact, at the very end of the video, we put a little page, you know, saying this is dedicated to the memory and the honor, you know, to honor the memory of Dr. Walter Williams. He was a professor at George Mason University. And but he died from the time we did the interview, you know, about a year and a half after it was done. But you also have David Gibbs III, Jenna Ellis, Bill Federer, and Dr. Cal Beissner, and others.
Well, and I noticed that Mike Huckabee is playing Thomas Jefferson. Michael Medved, another talk show host, is playing John Adams. Bob Sauer is narrator. Nick Mancuso is playing George Washington. I mean, that's amazing.
Yes.
You didn't have to twist your arm to get him to be in this, did you?
Well, you know what I did? This whole series on the Foundation of American Liberty series, which basically I've been working on for the last 3 or 4 years in my copious free time, and I've donated it, dedicated it to Providence Forum, for which I now serve as executive director. But the whole point was it all began with the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower, the voyage of the Mayflower. I thought this is such an incredible milestone in American history, and I just didn't see anybody out there, you know, banging the drum other than people and some people in Plymouth knowing and recognizing this is such a big deal. So I set out on this ambitious project, not only to celebrate the pilgrims and their lives and legacy and so forth, but just kind of basically to tell the whole story about how our Judeo-Christian roots lay at the, you know, it is basically what has made America so great, you know, the good parts of America. Obviously, there are some serious flaws in America, but a lot of these things have been rectified in the framework for these things to be corrected was actually set in place by great founders, like George Washington. I mean, they even say in the Constitution that they were striving for a more perfect union. And, they weren't perfect by any means. But the legacy that the settlers and the founders of America have given us are so strong and so positive. And, you know, in a nutshell, David, it boils down to this. Our rights come from the Creator. And the founders recognize that. And they built that into the very system itself. And so for all the flaws, which, again, they've rectified, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, that when the founders said all men are created equal in the Declaration of Independence, they gave us, that is, you know, we African Americans, they gave us a promissory note. We're now cashing in on that. He said that in the early 60s. Well, look at the progress that's been made since the early 60s, you know, in terms of the civil rights bills and things like that. So as Dr. Carol Swain, African American scholar, she used to teach at Vanderbilt and Princeton, she said that there isn't systemic racism in America today, not since those civil rights laws were passed. Now, there is racism sometimes, but it's not, you know, based on, you know, the system within the government itself. So it's just flawed people following their sinful nature. And so I think this is really important, because what's happening is the marches in the streets are essentially trying to cut us off from our true history, which includes God. I mean, God was at the center of so much. You know, put it this way. America was founded by Christians seeking religious liberty. They then turned around and gave that liberty to all. And now we're in a situation, as my good friend Bill Federer, one of the guests in this program, says, we're now in a situation where the first ones in the boat are getting kicked out by the last ones who came in the boat because, you know, they're basically trying to cancel culture, is trying to cancel Christians, the very ones who gave gave us all, you know, religious freedom and freedom of speech and so forth. So it's an amazing thing about America and the way our history is being treated. But history really matters, because a nation that doesn't know what it is or what it was yesterday doesn't know what it is today, or where it is going tomorrow.
Right. Well, now the chapter titles, we understand that this is all kind of spelled out throughout this narrative that you're doing. I'm going to just kind of go through each one of these, and if you could just kind of give me a few sentences about the most significant things about George Washington's childhood.
Okay.
Now, were you talking about the cherry tree here?
No, I didn't even mention that part, because there's a lot of people that question that. You know, it's interesting, though. Dr. Peter Loback and I wrote this big, thick book on the faith of Washington, which I believe I mentioned, George Washington's Sacred Fire, 1,200 pages, and 500 pages of those 1,200 pages are footnotes and endnotes and so forth. And one thing Loback did show in his research that I thought was interesting is that the story about George Washington and the cherry tree or whatever was told pretty early on. And in fact, there was even a vase, and he found a photograph of this vase in Germany, or from Germany, in the time of the lifetime and lifespan of George Washington, with that cherry tree story. So it doesn't matter. Bottom line is, George Washington received a Christian education, and then unfortunately that education was cut short by the untimely death of his father. But he really mastered a book of 110 maxims, and it's called Rules of Civility. They're all based on the Bible, though not directly Bible quotes. And if George Washington came off as aloof or dignified or whatever, much of it gets back to those maxims. And so we actually highlighted some of those maxims in the DVD or the video, because we felt that this is really, you know, an important part. It kind of shows you, you know, what he really believed. And George Washington became a very strong reader of the Bible, regular reader of the Bible, and of the Book of Common Prayer, the Anglican Anglican Book of Common Prayer, the 1662 version, so much so that his writings just are filled with scriptural references. It's almost as if you cut the man, he would have bled scripture. And so that's a comment about his childhood.
That's interesting. Now, we have another section called George Washington, the Churchman. Now, the thing is I believe the last time that we were on, you were talking about all these pastors and how they actually were involved in the spreading of volunteerism to serve in the military. And, of course, we're leading up to that. But the churchman, how was George Washington involved historically in the church?
Well, he was a vestryman, which is kind of like, if you're familiar with the position of elder and then also deacon, it was almost like both those two roles, those positions rolled into one person. But this involved him, you know, swearing loyalty and fealty to the Christian faith as understood by 18th century Anglican tradition and so forth. And they would say, so help me God. This is part of where the so help me God comes from. When George Washington was sworn in as our first president, he was sworn in, of course, on the Holy Bible. You can see that Bible yourself, by the way, if you ever go visit New York City. That's where he was sworn in as first president under the Constitution. And so he added the word, so help me God, as is was the custom of the Anglican Church. He also even leaned over and kissed the Holy Bible, and that became a part of it. And so one aspect of his church experience is that week after week after week, and he went to church on a regular basis, he would stand up with the congregation, and they would read the words of the Apostles' Creed as found on the reredos, which is the walls of the Anglican churches would have a reredos, and they would have the Lord's Prayer, they would have the Apostles' Creed, and they would also have the Ten Commandments. I bring that up because, you know, back then paper wasn't as common. You know, it was a kind of a way to save on money. Nowadays, we, you know, people will have PowerPoints. I was just in a worship service last night, and they had words up on the screen that were somehow projected through a PowerPoint or a computer or whatever. But in Washington's day, those words, you know, were just the permanent words of the Apostles' Creed, et cetera. And so anyway, Washington said the name of Jesus all the time and in reverence. Now, in his writings, he doesn't talk about Jesus all the time, but it's understood that he's talking within a Christian context. And Washington had a kind of a Baroque style, so he would often speak in very reverent terms about God. And so he called Jesus the ruler of the nations. That's based in Revelation chapter 12. He called Jesus the divine author of our blessed religion. It's kind of a paraphrase, part of the book of Hebrews. And there was just a great deal of reverence. Now, when he wrote to the Delaware Indian chiefs, he used the name of Jesus directly, where he says, you know, they came to him, the Delaware Indian chiefs, and they said, we want our sons to learn in your ways. And he said, well, you do well to know about our ways, our arts and life and so forth, but above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. And so, you know, talking to somebody outside of the Christian tradition, then he directly talks about Jesus Christ. But George Washington's writings are just filled with references to God and to providence, which is just another way of saying God. And I think a lot of this really does go back to his church experience, his life as a churchman.
Right. Now, when he goes into the military, he wasn't automatically the commander-in-chief, the way I understand it. He started, or was he picked to be that based on his stature at the time?
Well, George Washington served in the military when we were under the British, and that's where he started, in 1755. So 20 years before the push for independence, George Washington was an officer in the American, you know, among the American colonels or whatever, the American colonials, rather. And that was in tandem with working with the British when the British and the Americans and some of the Indians were fighting against the French and other Indians. And this is all, of course, part of the French and Indian War. Well, there was a massacre in July of 1755 when George Washington was 23. He was there. The commanding officer was killed. All these other officers were killed. In fact, every single officer in the British and the American Army at that time in that particular battle outside of Pittsburgh were killed except for George Washington. And there were even testimonies later that Washington learned about where this Indian chief said he visited him with Dr. James Craik, his great lifelong friend, who was a very devout Christian. They go into back into the Pennsylvania wilderness on a trip 15 years after the battle, and they met with this man, and he explained through interpreters, "I told my men there on the battlefield that day, you see that tall guy," and he was talking about George Washington, "mark him, kill him. You know, he is going to be trouble for us down the road." And he said that the men aimed their rifles. They shot at him. We know that George Washington had four bullets, you know, that went through his cloak. But he didn't get hit. He didn't get killed. He didn't get injured. He had horses, a couple horses shot underneath him. Finally, the Indian chief said to his men, "Stop shooting. The Great Spirit is protecting this man for some future purpose. You know, no more." And so they didn't shoot at him again. And this is the, you know, Washington was the only one that of the officers that was spared in the battle that day. Well, this kind of thing prepared him, jumping it forward 20 years later, when the U.S. Army, the United States was actually thinking on taking on Great Britain, because they just wanted their rights as Englishmen, and these rights were being denied. And so when there was this, you know, situation where there was a big push for independence, and of course George Washington was a part of that push, John Adams said before the Continental Congress, "I think George Washington should be the commander in chief of the troops." And that was approved, and then he served in that war, and it was very much of a Fabian type battle, or not battle, but series of battles, where he just basically he didn't have enough resources compared to the British, but he did manage to just kind of you know, win a skirmish here and a skirmish there, and then get the army away in time. And George Washington felt there were so many times where God intervened miraculously on behalf of the American cause that he said that you'd have to be worse than an infidel to not give thanks to God for the freedom we have. And in fact, in his first inaugural address, he said it would be crazy for me. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, English, but it would not be right for me to omit the very first obligation we have, which is to thank God that we have even become a nation. And he said nobody should be more grateful than the people of the United States for the freedom that we enjoy. It's because of God that we should, that we have this freedom, and we should be grateful to him. And so George Washington, you know, really did not like this ingratitude that, I mean, I'm sure if he were around today, he would be very upset with the incredible ingratitude people have about America, about God and his help to us even becoming a nation. But I would add one thing too, Dave, in the sense that there was a sacrificial element of George Washington and those that he led, where they sacrificed so that we could become free. They did all this on behalf of themselves, but also on behalf of their posterity. And here we are in America, and we're living in the era of the ungrateful American. I mean, it's mind-blowing when you get down to it. It's like,
it is.
Wow, we've received so much, and yet we don't give thanks to God. It's incredible. People bow the knee to the national anthem, and they're treating America like as if it's Nazi Germany or something, and it's just totally oppressive. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Well, it, yeah.
You know, it almost could, makes you want to go to the southern border. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it could almost turn into a Nazi nation if we don't get a handle on things, I'll tell you that much.
Well, that's true, too.
Yeah, while we have a minute here, are there any misconception or misinformation about Valley Forge? My understanding was that they were really short on rations. They didn't have any shoes on their feet. I mean, this is really, from what I understand, with the winter that they were facing at that battle, that they were just in really bad shape. Is that pretty much the scenario, or am I off base here?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And it was a terrible winter, and there were so many reports of George Washington, kneeling and praying for God to help them through this, and he did. But it was a difficult time. I mean, people died, soldiers died that winter, and so forth. And they were driven out by the British, who took over Philadelphia and so forth. So they had to go away, in the wilderness. But anyway, it's an amazing story of sacrifice, but also of God's help, and that George Washington constantly recognized God's help. Just to give one quick anecdote, because I know you're running out of time.
We sure
fast forward to when George Washington served as the president. He presided over the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787. It gets ratified the next year, and then the next year after that, 1789, April 30, George Washington gets sworn in as the first U.S. president under the Constitution. And he was approached by Congress real soon after, and they said, listen, we think you should write up a proclamation of thanksgiving to Almighty God in light of the fact that we have been able to peaceably assemble together and create our own government, of self-government under God. And we should write up a thank you note, in a sense, or a day of thanksgiving to God. And George Washington did that. He wrote it on October 3, 1789. And these are the very same men who later gave us the First Amendment, which today is being twisted around to mean, oh, you can't have somebody praying in a school. That's wrong. Providenceforum.org for more information on the where this video is available.
We appreciate that, Pastor Newsom. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
We'll be back after the break.
And harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com or text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. When talking of great immune support, a line of products comes to my mind. That's North American Herb and Spice. We carry the Rest Vital Calf, Sinew Araga, Oreganol Juice, Pure Lycee, Chaga Max, Collagen Power Plus, Oregarest, Super Strength Oregano Oil, Black Seed, and many more. Support small businesses when you buy from the good guys. Go to thepowermall.com or call 877-817-9829.
I don't know where to start. There's so many products you guys offer. I think one of the first things I ever ordered from you guys was your clay. The clay is miraculous. I could not do without that. And the charcoal, you know, you can get yourself in a bathtub to kind of help take the toxins out. So just those two alone, but I could go on to the Optivita silver lozenges. Of course, then the Oregarest and the P73, the oil of oregano, and your Vitamir toothpaste. Again, I could go on and on and on.
Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Minutes after the hour of 12 noon. This is Monday, February 21, 2022, President's Day. We thank you so much for joining us here on the Power Hour. Just remember, when you call the Power Mall today, you get $5 off when you spend $50 by using the code TAKE5 and $10 off when you spend $100 using the code TAKE10. That's at thepowermall.com, or you can call 877-817-9829. Last week, we tried to get a hold of Grace's dad, and of course, he was unavailable, and I really wanted to talk to him about this. I'm so glad that we had a chance to get him back on the show. And this is a problem that we're facing. We've talked about this before, folks, on this program. I have told you that I've experienced people I know who've called me up asking, oh my God, what should we do? You try to get a hold of an advocate. They have a patient advocate, which is like an ombudsman in hospitals, that are supposed to be, oh, wait a minute, they get paid by the hospital. Oh, gee, that sounds like they're connected in some way to serve the needs of the hospital and do damage control on behalf of the hospital rather than satisfy the needs of the patient as well as the family. And one of the reasons that we brought Grace Shara's father on the show is because I've heard of so many different cases. And I told our producer, Catherine, I said, we got to have Scott on the show. This is just unbelievable because what happened to him is happening to so many people. They have a loved one go in the hospital, which I just had a friend of mine in Florida. Her mom got diagnosed. They tested her. And these tests, of course, are 92% ineffective. Yet they stick these swabs up their nose. And then all of a sudden, if they've had a flu or any sniffle or anything like that, it might come back positive whether they have COVID or not. And immediately, and in my friend's case, they get cut off. Total. They can't see their loved one. Now you talk about, and the hospital sets about not taking care of them, and the person dies of sepsis because they weren't treated properly. And it's all because these hospitals are being incentivized when people have COVID to slap them on a ventilator and give them remdesivir and all this other garbage. Well, in Grace's situation, and she was a 19-year-old with Down syndrome, hospital protocol failed her family. Scott Shara, welcome to the Power Hour.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Could you, I guess people really need to hear your story, and I don't know any other way to go through. I know that it's agonizing probably to tell it, and I'm so sorry for what they did to your daughter. And even the fact that she was disabled or had a disability, she loved the Lord, and, you know, this is the thing. And I know you don't want her death to be in vain. We don't want it to be in vain either. And we just pray for her soul, knowing that, you know, you tried to do the right thing, but the hospital protocol failed you. So I'd like you to start from scratch. How did this whole thing happen? How did she end up in the hospital?
A
Okay, so just to, so reader or your listeners can understand a little bit of difference. So Grace was never on remdesivir, and she was never put on a ventilator. And so they just figured out another way is what happened. And on top of that, I was in the room as an advocate, which is exceptionally rare. I was taken out by an armed guard the fourth day, and then we were 44 hours without an advocate. And then my daughter Jessica came in as a replacement advocate after it was negotiated with between the attorneys. So that makes it unique. But you know, even as an advocate, they were able to do this. So how this started was we were on the frontline doctor's protocol. Grace developed what we thought was a cold on around September 28th. We then tested her on October 1st with a home test kit. She tested positive, and we really didn't think anything of it because we were well prepared. On October 6th, she was not able to maintain her oxygen saturation above 90, and so we decided to take her to urgent care. And just a sidebar with that, Dave, is that I went into the hospital 3 days after Grace died with symptoms about three times worse than hers, and we found through research that even if you are doing the best you possibly can, there is a small percentage of the population that has the propensity to clot and develop inflammation. And I knew that about me, and Grace inherited that from me, unfortunately. But regardless, we took her to then from urgent care to the emergency room, and she was, they put her on oxygen, and then she was fine. Her and I were just goofing off in the emergency room, but then the emergency room physician suggested that we check Grace into the hospital. So once I had said at that point, well, then I'll be staying with her. And they said, well, you can't. I said, well, then I'll be taking her home. And unfortunately, and I say this because Grace died, 2 hours later, they came back and said, well, we've approved for you to stay as long as you don't leave the room. And so we waited approximately 10 hours for a room to open up, and we got into a room, a COVID room on about midnight on October 7th. The first day in the hospital was just normal, you know, Dad goofing off with his best buddy. And the next day is when, you know, the sequence of events I'm going to tell you, I'm going to just pick on two of them because they really give you a perspective of what the care was like. So then the second day, which was October 8th, a doctor came in at 8 o'clock and said, you're going to have to put your daughter on a ventilator in the next 2 hours. And I said, what is that recommendation based on? And he said the blood draw, which was a blood gas draw they drew the night before. So I asked, what time was that drawn? And he said 11:30 p.m. And I said, I don't think that's accurate because we were wrestling on and off with Grace getting the oxygen situated. They had put her on a high flow cannula, which she didn't like, so we were switching over to a BiPAP. They only had adult masks, so we had to get a child mask. And you know, Grace was frustrated with it, and her beats per minute were at 150 at that time, and her blood pressure was 235 over 135. So I said, I want you to retake those numbers. And so they did, and she was fine. So we dodged the ventilator bullet then. But, you know, with the next story I'm going to tell you, which happened on October 9th, you know, what I've come to believe is that they're arbitrarily lowering the oxygen saturation numbers to put people on ventilators, and it's financially motivated. So they asked us four different times outside of that first time when they were requiring it, which we dodged, but then they asked us four other times for the permission to put her on a ventilator. So they wanted us to do a preemptive decision, and they couched it this way. They said, just in case something happens, these type of things tend to happen in the middle of the night when we can't get a hold of the family. And, you know, so we denied it every time because just get a hold of us. You know, but still, even then, we weren't going to put her on a ventilator because that's, you know, you're as good as gone once you're on a ventilator. And there never came a time where she needed one. So what was going on? So this next example I'll give you will share the perspective of what was happening. So on October 9th, Grace was hungry. She said, Dad, can you order some food? So I did, started feeding her, and a nurse came running in and said, you can't do that. I said, well, what's the reason? And she said, her oxygen saturation is only at 85. And so I started processing that. I thought, well, that's impossible. I had all of my COVID materials in the room because I knew almost with certainty I was going to get COVID while I was in there. So I had my own oxygen saturation meter. And so I put it on Grace's finger, and it read 95. So I called the nurse in and said, is my meter accurate? And she said, yes, it is. And I said, well, why is my $50 meter more accurate than your $50,000 machine? And she said, the leads get sweaty. I said, well, if you know that, I said, just think through what's happening. This is the primary statistic you're using to decide my daughter's care. So why don't you just change out those leads every 4 hours or whatever you need to do proactively so that we have accurate readings? And she snottily responded, you should just be thankful that you caught this. And, you know, we started getting wise to it then between myself and my daughter, Jessica. I mean, we measured the oxygen tens of times, and it was consistently off. You know, our meter was out reading higher. On Grace's last day, in fact, their machine was reading 50%, and the finger meter that we had was reading 93%. And so, you know, they want to get this ventilator in, and they will do any means possible. So ultimately, you know, After I was kicked out on the 10th, we should probably drill down Grace's last day. I don't know how much time we have, Dave, but why don't you give me a sense of that?
Well, no, I mean, we do, Scott. We have up until about 57 minutes, minutes to the hour. But the thing that I'm really puzzled by the fact that they just were so into, I mean, they get anywhere from 39,000 for a COVID patient going on a ventilator and dying up to $100,000. I mean, these hospitals, and this is not the first time that I've heard the insistence of putting them on a ventilator. So continue.
Well, it is. It actually approaches about $300,000 when they get them on a ventilator. They get a $39,000 bonus the day they put them on the ventilator. But the reason it ratchets up, the average COVID patient, they get a $100,000 bonus. So there's that's the average. The ventilator is makes the hospital in the neighborhood of $300,000 because the average hospital stay is 22 days, and they can keep that patient alive on that ventilator up until they die for an extended period of time. So they're getting an ICU bonus and then all the insurance payments for 22 days in the hospital. So it approaches $300,000. So you can see if you're financially motivated why you would want to do that. So anyway, I got kicked out. So at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 10th of October, the head nurse and an armed guard came in the room and said, you need to leave immediately. And I said, what is that based on? And she said, you've been shutting off the alarms at night. And I said, well, I had the nurses train me how to do that because they're going off 20, 30 times a night. And oftentimes it's 30 minutes before they come in and shut them off. And then she said, well, the last three shifts of nurses don't want you in the room. And obviously, you know why after I just shared the stories that I just did. You know, they don't want me in the room. They don't want me in the room because of the fact that I am, you know, I'm challenging things. And then the third thing, which is the most surprising, and this is the excuse the hospital used in their report, is that I had COVID. Well, I mean, they're the ones who told me I was going to get COVID. So, of course, I have COVID. My daughter's spewing COVID in the room. And if you were so concerned about it, why weren't you testing me every day? You know, I tested myself on October 7th and knew I was positive. But, I mean, it was predictable, and they told me I was going to get it. So, anyway, then we go through this 44-hour period where we don't have advocacy. My daughter, Jessica, finally gets in the room, and she spent the entire day and night with Grace on the day before Grace's last day, October 12th. And Grace had a good day. You know, the sisters were bonding. They watched a movie before Grace went to bed that evening. My daughter Jessica has two sons, our grandsons, Grace's nephews, and she sat up in bed and hollered through the BiPAP, "Hi, boys!" You know, she was doing, in spite of the protocol, she was doing okay, and she was doing well. The next morning, so now Grace's last day, it's significant to walk through this. So she starting at 8 o'clock that morning, the doctor called us and wanted our decision on a ventilator, meaning the preemptive decision, not to put her on one. But this was the fifth time that they asked for this. And we said, no, we're not going to give you that authority to put her on a ventilator. Then the sequence I'm going to share with you, it's very hard to stomach. So what I'm telling you, I have all my research on our website. If people want to look, it's hard to stomach. So the doctor, when he called us then, said, well, Grace had such a good day, we would like to put her on a feeding tube. And the reason a feeding tube is because they denied me feeding her. They denied Jessica feeding her. And so Grace was getting malnutrition. Well, she never needed to be malnutrition. All they need to do was care for her like she's going to live versus starving her. So then Jessica wanted to take a shower. So when I was in the room, they wouldn't let me leave. Now Jessica wants to take a shower, and they said, well, you have to go home and take one. And so she runs home. She's back inside of an hour. She overhears the two doctors and a nurse in the hallway say, the parents aren't going to like this. And so she asks, what aren't they going to like? And they said, well, we had to restrain Grace. Restrain Grace means strap her down to the bed. So she said, why? Well, she wanted to get out of bed and go to the bathroom. Like, you can't, it's just so sickening when I replay that in my mind. And, you know, one of the attorneys that we've talked with said, Scott, do you think they would have strapped you down to the bed if you had to go to the bathroom? He said, absolutely not. So that got me thinking, you know, they did this because they could, because Grace has Down syndrome. Anyway, then I'm going to backtrack a little bit, but it sets this up. So they had Grace on a sedation drug that we were unaware of for 4 days prior. The sedation drug is called Presidex. They do this because they get an ICU bonus the day you go on Presidex. And then it sets up a ventilator because now the patient is kind of drugged up. Well, what happened is they put her on a real low dose 4 days before. By 10:48 in the morning, Grace's last day, they had her on a 14 times original dose. And they used the strapping down to the bed. Now Grace, you know, she's frustrated. So now they sedate her more. The next thing is they try the feeding tube, which they got the feeding tube in. Now she's agitated more. So now they've got her at a 14 times dose at 10:48 in the morning. Now we go into the last hour of her life at 5:26. Now she's still on this 14 times dose of Presidex. At 5:26, they gave her a dose of lorazepam. 3 minutes later, they gave her another dose of lorazepam. Then at 6:15, they gave her a 2 milligram dose of morphine as an IV push, which means they gave it to her in an instant. So now she's got three drugs that are not supposed to be combined in 29 minutes in her system. And she died an hour and 15 minutes later. So they figured out a way to take her out. You know, that's what I've concluded, because we wouldn't approve the payday of the ventilator. And so now what happened next is even more inconceivable. So now 6:15 happens. After that, shortly after that, she starts to feel cold. My daughter Jessica tries to get nurses in the room, and they said, well, that's normal. Well, it's not normal at all. It's normal if you want to take somebody out. And so then at 7:20, Jessica calls Cindy, my wife, and I, panicking that Grace's numbers are dropping. I said, get the nurses in. She said, Dad, I've tried. They won't come in the room. So we're hollering at these nurses, save our daughter. And they holler back from outside the room, she's DNR, do not resuscitate. That's the first we knew. Jessica runs out in the hall, but what's going on? And the nurse reads off the computer that the doctor ordered a DNR and they can't do anything about it. So, I mean, this doctor unilaterally ordered a DNR.
Scott, I got to stop you there. DNR can only be because my mom was DNR. And she was 95 years old when she passed away, and I had to be there and have copies of all that material and had to be agreed to by her or by her medical surrogate. It had to be in writing before they could do DNR. So everything I'm hearing so far, I mean, besides being in violation of Wisconsin State Statute 154, which is in my show notes here, everything they did, it looks like medical murder to me.
Absolutely. And the DNR, they violated statute 154 in at least three spots. You know, when we said save our daughter, when they say she's DNR, then we said she's not DNR, save our daughter. Even the doctor ordered DNR, which was illegal, that statement by us overrides it, and they're supposed to save her. The morphine package insert, I think I referred to that earlier, says to not combine morphine with those two drugs, but as it applies to the DNR, they're supposed to be bedside with a reversal drug because of potential problems. They did none of that. And Dave, it gets worse than that. There was an armed guard outside the room. So what's the reason? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, is he preventing the nurses that would have a heart to come in and save from, prevent them from coming in and saving Grace? Was he preventing, or was he, it was a male armed guard, was he preventing my daughter from pulling one of these nurses in? Were they afraid I'm coming back? I don't know. But how we got clued into this was then after Grace died, I took my wife, so we watched Grace die on FaceTime at 7:27. We couldn't say goodbye to her. I mean, she just was gone. So I drive my wife to the hospital. Her and Jessica clean Grace up. Our pastor met us there. The funeral director meets them there. And afterward, I couldn't go in, so I just sat in the truck because I had COVID. The pastor takes Cindy out in a wheelchair. One of the nurses bends down to Cindy. She's taking Grace's belongings out in a cart and says, me and several of the other nurses don't think Grace should have died today. So that started our whole process of getting the records as fast as we could. And now I have almost 500 hours of research in this, Dave. This has become my full-time job. This is what I am doing now. Fortunately, I have a mature business and my guys are running it. But this is a big deal. We got to get the word out.
Yes, you do. And this is something that is so scary because other people, when you realize that you take the word of a doctor or an ER physician and all of a sudden you admit them to a hospital when they could have been treating them with alternative therapies, like these frontline doctors that, Scott, you said that you had been working with them and, you know, your situation. I mean, you obviously recovered. And Grace was only 19. Jessica was traumatized because of everything that was done. And of course, you're not the only one that they've had an armed security guard come in and take a loved one out because they wanted the hospital to do the right thing. And I don't see anything other than a medical malpractice suit against multiple parties and calling up every single nurse on that shift to come in and testify. Because the nurses know more than the doctors do. I know this because I worked in medicine. So, you know, when I see stuff like this, and they have all these contraindications at the ready, and they know that giving Precedex, lorazepam, and morphine is a deadly combination, and they did it anyway, knowing they would kill her, I mean, this is like premeditated murder.
That's exactly right. And what makes it, people aren't, you know, there's a believability factor with the story, unfortunately. You know, so when people hear me, they are thinking this can't be true. And what I would share is that, you know, I'm 58 years old. So the paradigm was under with hospitals, unfortunately, caused Grace's death. You know, that's my role in it because you just believe the white coat. I mean, they're there to help you. And the new paradigm is that they are extensions of the government. And the government is using the bonus money to strong arm them to do things that are immoral, illegal, unethical, unconscionable, all those things. I went to a completely different hospital, of course, after Grace died, and they didn't buy into the protocol. They did everything exactly opposite, including nebulizer treatments, vitamins, probiotics, you know, everything that you would think this is what a hospital should do. And so they're not all in on it, but you know, you can't wait until you get to the hospital to figure this out. Very few people should ever check themselves in. If you do need to check yourself in, you can't wait till you get there to figure this out. You got to do it in advance. But if you do need to go to the emergency room, what I know now is that we would have taken Grace home and they would have prescribed oxygen and a steroid and Grace would be alive today.
Yeah, that is really sad that we have to go by what the doctor says. And the doctor, you know, I like I said, Ron DeSantis has this bill sitting in front of him that basically says that, you know, hospitals. And of course, I know that it's the Republicans in the Florida legislature that are basically saying, hey, we need to do something to protect the industry. And obviously they when you donate money to politicians' campaigns, you owe them. So here you have these hospitals saying, well, we don't want to be sued for all these deaths that we're making all this money from. So do us a favor and pass this legislation and keep us out of the soup. And so the governor now is tasked with all of his constituents screaming at him to veto this bill that would take the hospitals off the hook. What is the status of this in Wisconsin? Do you have recourse?
Unfortunately, no. Grace was an adult, so the loss of companionship claim, which is one recourse we don't have, because you have to be it has to be a child that dies. The medical malpractice is a potential recourse. We talked with probably the best malpractice attorney in the state, and he encouraged us to not do anything because he said it's only a 1 in 10 chance, even in slam dunks like this, because they circle the wagons, and we would be going up against Ascension Hospital System. The hospital, or the hospital Grace died at is one of 142 in the Ascension system, and they have $26 billion in the bank. You know, so you know they're not going to lose a case like this. I met with a lieutenant this morning in the local police department to see about a criminal case, and he was super impressed with everything that we put together, because it's all, like I said, all the research I have is on the website. And but he said, we don't have the resources, Scott. And you know, I get it. You know, so that the lawsuit piece of this, I think, will come. I was introduced to Tom Renz, thankfully, and Tom wants to help us. And yeah, so it's wonderful. I think it'll all come together. But right now, we didn't want the lawsuit to be the focus. We want to get the focus on getting this word out.
No doubt. Well, what is the website that people can go and look? And maybe even if you set up a Give, Send, Go account or something where people can help donate to the cause, because there are a lot of good-natured people out there that'll do that. What is the name of the website?
Yeah, and that's on the website, the link. It's OurAmazingGrace.net.
All right, OurAmazingGrace.net. Thank you, Scott Schar, for sharing your story. And again, I'm so sorry for the loss of your daughter. We all are. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back tomorrow with more news and information. Until then, God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
All heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiatics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.